Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, May 15th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt's Measure Z revenue gets lean. Magnitude 4 earthquake jolts residents Tuesday evening. And rural water districts make upgrades. But what will it mean for their customers? Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. A magnitude 4 earthquake jolted residents from Blue Lake to Eureka last night, with over 800 residents submitting a felt report on the USGS website. Although the North Coast has experienced over 300 aftershocks since the large earthquake in December of 2022, this recent tremor was not related to that sequence. Our region's earthquake expert shares more.
I'm Lori Dengler, Emeritus Professor of Geology at Cal Poly Humboldt, and I've been studying earthquakes and tsunamis on the North Coast and elsewhere for as long as I can remember. So yes, at 11:39 p.m., an earthquake with a preliminary magnitude of 3.9 located about 5 miles southeast of Blue Lake. It was fairly deep. It was about 16 miles beneath the Earth's surface.
Dengler stated that on the North Coast, the depth of an earthquake plays a significant role in how it's felt.
The shallower an earthquake is, the more strongly it will be felt close to the epicenter. The deeper an earthquake, the wider field. So for this particular earthquake, you can kind of imagine almost all of coastal Humboldt County is pretty much the same distance away from it because it's 16 miles beneath the surface. So just kind of imagine Eureka's not really that much further away than Blue Lake when you're looking at it in three dimensions. And so this earthquake was widely felt. There was at least one felt report in Mendocino County, a couple of felt reports very close to the Oregon border in Crescent City and Gaski. So that's not surprising for a magnitude 4 earthquake, especially one on shore that's relatively deep.
Despite the hundreds of aftershocks recorded since December 2022, this event was unrelated.
This is a totally different kind of earthquake. It has nothing to do with the triple junction. As far as this earthquake was concerned, the triple junction did not exist.
Last night's earthquake was in the subductive zone of the Gorda Plate,
the slab that's beneath us. So we are living on the North American Plate. The North American Plate starts at about 45, 50 miles offshore, sort of right about at the base of the continental shelf, and extends all the way east to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So a lot of geometry there, a lot of real estate in the North American Plate, but we're on that very thin edge. In fact, where we are, that North American Plate, most of us on the coast, it's only anywhere between 6 miles beneath Petrolia, about 8 miles beneath Eureka and Arcata, about 12 miles beneath Willow Creek. So we're on that sort of the leading edge of the North American Plate. What separates us from the Gorda Plate beneath us is the Cascadia subduction zone.
That area beneath Eureka and Arcata is tightly locked.
It's stuck by friction, the combination of the weight and the fact that the temperature isn't too high means those two sides are stuck together, and they've been stuck together for over 300 years. So the last time that interface slip occurred was in 1700. We don't know when the next one will be. Could be this afternoon, could be 200 years from now, could be even a little longer. So any rate, that's that mega thrust boundary where things are stuck.
Dangler emphasized that due to its location, a tsunami was not a threat from this event.
Obviously, this earthquake never had the potential to produce a tsunami, even if it had been much bigger because it was onshore. You really have to have deformation of the seafloor in order to produce a tsunami.
She explained that earthquakes causing short-duration shaking do not typically generate tsunamis. However, if the ground shakes for minutes, residents should evacuate to higher ground. On social media, residents expressed concern about not receiving an alert for last night's event. Dangler addressed the issue and outlined the criteria for triggering alerts.
It's designed for earthquakes where taking an action is going to help protect you. And a magnitude 3.9 or 4 or 4.2 is not going to harm you in terms of knocking something over on you or in that sort of way. So the reason you didn't get an alert, even if you've signed up for MyShake, is because this earthquake was just a little too small to trigger that system.
Dangler concluded by emphasizing that our area is extremely seismically active, making education and preparedness crucial.
Being aware that, yes, there is an earthquake hazard, what might happen if there is an earthquake? Well, things could fall off of shelves. Maybe there are things you can do to reduce that falling off shelves. Maybe you live in a tsunami zone. We just released a brand new copy, a brand new edition of Living on Shaky Ground that has lots of new information, updated information. I think it has much nicer graphics. Anyone can pick up copies. Right now, they're available at the National Weather Service office in Eureka. But we're happy to get copies of them to various locations and organizations around the county.
For more information or to request resources, you can email Professor Emeritus Lori Dangler at Lori, Lori.Dangler, Dengler, at Humboldt.edu. Or you can visit the Redwood Coast Tsunami Working Group's website to download a PDF of the 2024 Living on Shaky Ground catalog. That's rctwg.humboldt.edu. A southern Humboldt road is among the things Humboldt County's Measure Z tax will pay for in the coming budget year. But the Board of Supervisors is bracing for less money in the future. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Spending recommendations for the Measure Z public safety sales tax have been approved by Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors, including $500,000 to repave 2 miles of southern Humboldt's Matoll Road. But as the spending calls were made, supervisors were warned that next year's Measure Z scenario will be leaner due to declining sales revenue. Preliminary Measure Z decisions were made at the May 7th supervisors meeting. Deputy County Administrative Officer Sean Quincy said $4.3 million is available to fund new requests for the fiscal year beginning July 1st. The recommended projects are the Matoll Road repaving, replacing heavy public works equipment, a school resource officer for the Eel River Valley area, an evacuation alert software system, and $2.1 million for the county's fire departments. Quincy said, quote, "Essentially, we are taking money that is in the bank to bolster Measure Z spending," and Glenn Zimmer, a longtime member of the Measure Z Advisory Committee, said next year's funding will drop.
The difficulty we're going to have, and I think it's a difficulty the committee is completely capable of overcoming within the context of the committee process, is that there will be so little money available in the discretionary process next year that we would be unable to fund even 50% of what has historically been our number one rated application, which is the fire districts. So we're going to have to, as a committee, adapt to that new circumstance, and we'll have to make some very strong decisions about how we feel the community is best served.
There were references to the advisory committee's discussions as being difficult and uncomfortable, and what was described as a new process for Measure Z spending is in the works. Deputy Public Works Director Bob Bronkel, a member of the advisory committee, said the current process is contentious.
Back in December of 2023, the board adopted a spending plan that set aside specific dollar amounts for specific categories of funding. And I think that is the direction that the board may wish to go with the Measure Z committee. And the reason for that is you have all these different categories of things that need to be funded, and we're creating a situation where all the applications, which are really good, they're all important, they all need to be funded, they're all competing against one another in a dog-eat-dog competition for ranking for funding. And the idea that I have is that the board could perhaps expand upon the spending plan to represent all of the categories that are mentioned in the ballot measure.
Supervisor Steve Madrone vouched for the road improvement spending and said expectations of what Measure Z can do were unrealistic.
You know, if we made any mistakes at all in Measure Z, which I frankly think the committee's done an amazing job of representing the community, one of the mistakes was perhaps overpromising what ultimately Measure Z could do. Even in good sales tax times, it's still not enough money to do all the things that were on that list that, again, Bob Bronkel shared the list of the priorities that were in the ballot measure, and roads was one of those. And really, it's only this time around that roads are looking to get significant funding. There's been a little bit here, a little bit there, but mostly not.
Supervisors unanimously voted to direct county staff to work the funding recommendations into the coming fiscal year's budget. There was $45,000 left over, and after some discussion, supervisors agreed to award it to the city of Arcata for a school-based juvenile diversion officer. The funding will only contribute to the officer's pay, and Supervisor Mike Wilson said the city will cover the majority of the cost. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
New electronic water meters, courtesy of state funding, will be installed for Redway Community Services District customers. The new devices will allow for real-time tracking of water usage, a benefit for both the customer and the district. The meters will also help the district track whether customers have accessory dwelling water usage and are now considering requiring backflow device installation for all customers. KMUD's Lisa Music reports.
Customers of the Redway Community Services District will be treated to new meters funded through a SEAT program. The new digital meters will allow both the district and customers to view their water usage in real time. General Manager Cody Cox discussed the meters with the RCSD board during their April meeting.
It's part of the Department of Water Resources Emergency Water Storage and Supply Project. So we have some very dated, some over 35 years old, meters in the ground. We secured 750 electronic or AMI automated meter infrastructure meters in the grant. We've already received the first shipment of 125, putting in about 30 a month right now. We're kind of cruising on that and getting better at it. So what that means for our ratepayers is that obviously they're new meters, but there's a water scope feature on it. It's called water scope, and it allows the ratepayers to look at their usage and all the other applications that it has that come along with it, like, you know, adding alarms, all that stuff. You can set all that stuff up.
Cox said replacing old meters allows the district to track water usage more accurately, and with the digital meters being installed, reader meters will become a thing of the past, though periodic inspections will still occur. The new meters will not only allow the district to catch water leaks between billing cycles, it will allow RCSD staff to track water usage trends in regards to another district concern, accessory dwelling water usage, an often discussed topic at RCSD board meetings.
As far as the motorhomes and the trailers go, yeah, we're going to have the electronic meters going in. We will know when they've came into that parcel. Obviously, we'll be able to see the detail of the flow, and everything is largely enforceable through our electric meters.
The RCSD board has been working on updating their policies to reflect current laws and regulations while addressing concerns facing the district. The current ADU, or accessory dwelling unit, policy states that the district may require a detached ADU to have a separate connection, a requirement that would result in a lofty one-time service connection fee, as well as a monthly minimum bill of over $130. However, Cox updated the board, stating that state laws designed to encourage ADU construction to alleviate the state's housing shortage crisis would not allow them to make such a requirement. Though added monthly service revenue helps fund the district's operational costs, the additional cost, if required, could pose an economic hardship for county residents, which, according to the U.S. Census, have a median income of under $58,000 annually, with 18% of the county's residents living below the poverty level. Regardless, Cox stated the district staff would be monitoring water use carefully.
We can absolutely not give them another separate unit. Nope. And they get to share the same trunk line of sewer.
Right.
The whole point of an ADU is because of the hardship of Americans and all that. So, like, that's the whole thing.
Another concern for the district is cross-connection contamination from ADUs, though Cox stated he has a plan for that.
Careful of is making sure that any ADUs that go in will require a backflow device and maybe even a larger size meter for flow. Those are the things that we can do it, but it needs to be spelled out in the language in the ordinance.
Cox explained the issues surrounding cross connections and how to mitigate potential issues, not only with ADUs, but all RCSD customers.
A cross connection and backflow prevention protection is water that goes through a meter to a ratepayer. That water, we don't want that water back. We don't want reversal flow. We don't want anybody getting sick. We don't know what's on that side of the meter. That water is considered used at that point, and we prevent it from coming back. So some of the things that can cause that are auxiliary water supplies, such as wells, pressure tanks, fire flow systems, so on and so forth.
To date, RCSD has been following Title 17 guidelines for backflow device requirement guidance. However, Cox stated that it is only a matter of time before the district will need a policy of their own.
We're going to need an actual written program. We can't just live off of Title 17 anymore. It's going to be based off of that, but we need our own program that's specific to our district and our degrees of hazards that exist in our district for potential cross connections.
Board member Marie Etherton asked if only connections with a deemed risk of cross-connection would be required to have the devices installed. But Cox suggested every RCSD connection should have a backflow device requirement.
So in my opinion, as a cross-connection control specialist, the answer to that question is yes. If you have a pool, you need a backflow device. If you have a fire flow system, you need a backflow device.
How do we know if we have one of those?
That is in the inspections part of this, which is in the general manager report. I'm going to be conducting inspections as we install meters. The degree of hazard and the surveys will be conducted. We have backflow assemblies coming, and we're going to be using double check valve assemblies.
In addition to costs incurred by the district, the RCSD ratepayers will also bear direct cost to the backflow device implementation the district is considering.
This is going to be a touchy situation because it is up to the homeowner to pay for this based on the degree of hazard, you know, that dictates what backflow goes in.
The latest report from the RCSD states that RCSD customers owe over $139,000 in unpaid water and sewage fees, with 24 residences currently disconnected due to payment failure. Cognizant of financial hardships to their customers, the GM and board members discussed assuming some of the labor costs associated with the backflow device installation.
I'm suggesting that we install some of these at our cost, but then as far as these require an annual test. And so they have to be tested every single year. So it's an annual test, and some districts require two. So if we cover the installation, they must pay for the tests and repairs every year.
Cox estimated each double-check valve to cost RCSD customers $150 and the annual test of each unit to cost around $35. If the device fails the test, repairs and an additional test will also be billed to the customer. Board member Michael McCaskill encouraged those present to find an affordable, if not free, option to alleviate the financial burden from RCSD customers.
I mean, I would love to charge them nothing if it really takes 10 minutes for almost all of them.
We can't do that.
Though an added cost to a struggling customer base may seem counterproductive to the RCSD ratepayers already struggling to meet current bills, Cox, a certified backflow device inspector, encouraged the board to move forward with a district program.
We're doing ourselves a huge favor if we put these backflows in now, because I'm telling you, the state's coming down on this and requiring us to have our own program. You can't just say, oh, we're Title 17. You know, we do everything that that says, which nobody ever does. It has to be specific in your own program. So it's up to the local water purveyor, and any district or purveyor that has a program must have a specialist, and we have a specialist.
The next meeting of the RCSD board will be held on May 22nd at 5:30 p.m. at the RCSD offices located at 1150 Evergreen Road, Suite 2 in the Meadows Business Park in Redway. For KMUD News, I'm Lisa Music.
KMUD's Matt LaFever brings the latest headlines out of Mendocino County, where a former NFL player has found himself caught up in a bungled burglary.
This is Matt LaFever with the headlines out of Mendocino County for Wednesday, May 15th, 2024. To start, we explore the intriguing tale of a former NFL player, Gregory Mark Cox, whose life journey has taken an unexpected turn, culminating in recent events in Mendocino County. Gregory Mark Cox, once a standout for the New York Giants and the San Francisco 49ers, now finds himself at the center of alleged criminal activities in Mendocino County. Last week, Cox and an accomplice, Amanda Chapman, were arrested after a botched robbery attempt in Leggett, resulting in a homeowner being shot in the hand. Cox had a long path to the NFL. Hailing from Niagara Falls, New York, he overcame challenges during high school in Columbus, Ohio, before making a name for himself at Hartnell Junior College in Salinas, California, and later at San Jose State University. In 1988, Cox entered the NFL as a free agent safety with the San Francisco 49ers, contributing to their Super Bowl victory the following year. Cox's career was not without controversy. After a stint with the New York Giants, where clashes with coach Bill Parcell made headlines, Cox faced legal issues, including a high-profile trial on rape and false imprisonment charges in Monterey County. His last season of football was 1991, but Cox remained in the public eye from a 2008 robbery arrest to a federal indictment for unlawful firearm possession in 2016. Now, in Mendocino County, Cox is once again in the spotlight, facing new felony charges of conspiracy and attempted robbery. At this point, we await further developments from the Mendocino County District Attorney's Office. Now let's turn to a celebration of California's rich cannabis heritage with the Cannabis Trail, a collaborative travel experience stretching from Santa Cruz to the storied landscape of the Emerald Triangle. The Cannabis Trail, likened to the iconic Napa Wine Road, has teamed up with Visit Oakland, Humboldt County Visitors Bureau, and Visit Mendocino County to offer an engaging exploration of cannabis culture. Peter Games, President and CEO of Visit Oakland, emphasizes the significance of this evolving tourism experience in the wake of legalization. Research indicates a growing interest in cannabis-motivated travel, with approximately 72 million Americans seeking active leisure experiences related to cannabis. Mendocino County, situated amidst the renowned landscape of the Emerald Triangle, is a cornerstone of the Cannabis Trail, featuring distinctive destinations such as Plant Shop, The Bohemian Chemist, and Sol de Mendocino. Oakland, California, a pioneer in cannabis equity licensing, and the Redwood Line vistas of Mendocino and Humboldt counties provide the perfect backdrop for this curated journey into cannabis history. Visitors on the Cannabis Trail will encounter immersive storytelling, meeting legacy craft cannabis farmers, and exploring farms where cannabis is cultivated alongside food crops and natural surroundings. Julie Benbow, the executive director of the Humboldt County Visitors Bureau, said, quote, "We are excited to finally be able to welcome visitors to our legendary cannabis farms and introduce them to our skilled farmers and artisan makers," unquote. Founded in 2015, the Cannabis Trail, led by Brian Applegarth, invites travelers to discover the milestones of the cannabis legalization movement across Northern California. Learn more about this immersive journey at thecannabistrail.com. And now to Ukiah, where a recent Ukiah Police Department incident resulted in the discovery of drugs and a firearm. On Sunday, May 12, 2024, Ukiah Police Department officers responded to a report of a man asleep behind the wheel of a running vehicle at a Wells Fargo in Ukiah. Upon arrival, officers found Joseph Ornelius unconscious in his idling minivan. Suspecting drug influence, they discovered drug paraphernalia on his person, including a glass pipe used for methamphetamine. A subsequent search of the subject's vehicle revealed a loaded ghost gun, an unserialized firearm, underneath the driver's seat, posing serious public safety concerns due to its untraceable nature. Ornelius was arrested for multiple charges, including possession of a controlled substance while armed with a loaded firearm and possession of drug paraphernalia. And now the highlights from a recent Redwood Valley Municipal Advisory Council meeting held on May 8, 2024. The council addressed topics to prepare for the upcoming fire season, featuring insights from the Fire Safe Council on wildfire readiness. Emily Tecchio, County Coordinator for the Mendocino Fire Safe Council, shared valuable resources and programs aimed at protecting homes from fire hazard. This included community chipper days, assistance for seniors and disabled individuals in creating defensible space, and road clearing initiatives. Mendocino County Sheriff Matt Kendall provided updates on law enforcement matters, highlighting new hires and ongoing efforts to combat crime. Of particular concern is the emerging issue of fentanyl trafficking, which Sheriff Kendall likened to a, quote, narcotic silk road, unquote, infiltrating Mendocino County. Another significant discussion at the meeting centered around the Fijian gas station permit, pending review by Caltrans and the County Department of Transportation. MAC Chair Dolly Riley noted concerns about traffic studies and the potential impacts on Highway 101. Redwood Valley resident Gizmo Henderson emphasized fire prevention related to dragging tire chains, citing instances where such sparks had triggered devastating fires. The council voted to send a letter urging educational efforts on this issue to state agencies and lawmakers. In cannabis-related updates, Sheriff Kendall addressed changing federal policies and the anticipated shift from illegal to legal cannabis markets. He highlighted concerns over the impact on local economies and public safety. Members of the Municipal Advisory Committee also discussed community projects, including the potential conversion of the abandoned Redwood Valley School into a community center, an initiative led by Mary Beth Kelly. And that's the latest from Mendocino County. I'm Matt Lefevre in Hopland, reporting for KMUD News.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lisa Music, and Matt Lefevre. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Lauren Schmidt. Thank you.